This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After releasing 10 albums, my guest singer-songwriter and guitarist Steve Earle has published his first book. It's a collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses. Several of the stories are based on Earle's own life. Steve Earle moved to Nashville at the age of 19 and recorded his first album in 1986. In the 90s, he developed heroin and cocaine addictions. In 94, he was convicted for possession of narcotics. While serving several months in prison, followed by rehab, he gave up drugs. His 1995 comeback album, Train A-Comin', launched what Nick Hornby described in The New Yorker as one of the most creatively successful careers in contemporary American music. Hornby says, "Who else has recorded five good to great albums in 6 years?" Earle has also established himself as a record producer. He started his own company, E Squared, and has produced albums by Ron Sexsmith and Lucinda Williams. Later he'll read from his book. Let's start with the title song from Steve Earle's latest CD, Transcendental Blues. Steve Earle, welcome back to Fresh Air. When did you start writing fiction?
There's a story in here called Wheeler County, which I actually started in 89 or 90 thinking it was going to be a novel. But the truth of the matter was my drug habit was getting out of hand by that time, and I was having trouble even finishing records by that point, and I started pawning everything that wasn't tied down in my house, including the computer that the book was in, and I never backed it up, so that's gone forever. And when I got clean and got out of jail, I hadn't written a song in 4.5 years, and I wrote another record fairly easily, but I guess I was a little paranoid in there, and it seemed to me like I had all this time and energy on my hands because I didn't have to wake up and find $500 worth of dope, so there wasn't always a melody lying around, so I started writing fiction to write something every day as an exercise. I'm not even sure I ever really thought about publishing it at first. And the first thing I did was I reconstructed Wheeler County from memory and found out it was only a short story after all.
All right. Well, now when you write, you have your choice of fiction, nonfiction, or lyric.
Well, I also write poetry, and I'm writing a play. I write all the time, and I think writing in a lot of different, areas. I think the last record that I made, Transcendental Blues, I think the writing changed quite a bit, and I think it's a direct result of writing prose and writing poetry.
How do you think it changed?
I think it's more poetic. I think, doing this, writing stories is pretty close to what I do as a songwriter anyway, and as a songwriter, the long story songs, the songs that are basically narrative that rhymes, that's the easiest thing for me to do. It's always tougher for me to do something that's a lot less words and a lot more emotionally driven than it is, something that's a story with a beginning and a middle and an end.
I'd like to take a subject about which you've written a song, a short story, and a nonfiction piece, and the subject is witnessing an execution. We'll start with the song, but before we hear it, tell us a little bit about the person whose execution you witnessed.
His name was Jonathan Wayne Nobles, and he was one of several people that I corresponded with on death row around the country. And at one time, I think that was what the extent of my activism was. I knew some guys on death row. They wrote me. I wrote them back. And I probably got a little too close, and John was in Texas, and he eventually got a date, and he wasn't innocent. He was guilty. For some reason, innocent guys don't write me. All my guys are guilty. But he asked me to witness his execution, and I was totally unprepared for that and didn't know how to say no, so I said yes. He just wanted one person there that didn't hate him.
What was he guilty of? What was he convicted of?
A really, really heinous double murder. John was probably, in his own estimation, he was an escalating sexually driven serial killer that happened to get caught the first time.
How did you end up corresponding with people on death row?
I wrote a song in 1990 called Billy Alston, and I've always been opposed to the death penalty. I grew up in Texas in a home that was opposed to the death penalty, and it was just what I was taught. I was just taught that's probably not a good thing for us to be as a people and for our government to be involved in doing, for a lot of reasons. Then I wrote a song called Billy Alston that sort of deals with the subject, and then people from the movement started calling and writing me, and then inmates started writing me. And over the years, then my life got out of hand. And when I came back shortly after I started making records and being visible again, Tim Robbins called me, and he had just finished Dead Man Walking, and he asked me to write a song for that soundtrack, and that was LS Unit 1. And then all of the cast members of that soundtrack record did a benefit here in L.A. for murder victims' families for reconciliation. And meeting those people was a mind blower because they're murder victims' family members who are opposed to the death penalty and go out and work against the death penalty every day. Bud Welch's daughter was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing as a member. And they changed my life and the way that I approach my activism against the death penalty in this country.
So tell me something about what you saw or what you felt when you were witnessing Jonathan Wayne Noble's execution that ended up in the song that you wrote.
Well, I think the deal with John is he was suspicious of abolitionists, and his first priority, I think, was the victims' family members, including, in fact, he met with. 2 weeks before he was killed, he met with the mother of one of his victims. John had changed. They didn't kill the same guy that they locked up. He still was very confused by what he did, but he converted to Catholicism, and he was a third order Dominican by the time he died. And he was a huge supporter of other people on death row. He stood up with Cliff Boggess, who was executed a year before him, who is another one of my correspondents, as his godfather at his baptism. And he started out being one of the most hated people by inmates and guards alike when he got there. And, you know, 12 years later, when they killed him, he was loved by everyone at Ellis. In fact, I spent most of the day after he was executed, delivering flowers and other gifts to people, a long list of people that worked for the prison system that John wanted to make sure that they knew that he appreciated, you know, what they'd done for him.
Yeah, in your song, there's a line about who he wants, what his radio and his fan given to.
Yeah, John was, they've moved the guys in Texas now. Back then they were on LS1 unit, which wasn't air conditioned, and it's Texas. And in fact, a year before John was executed, a diabetic death row inmate died in his cell from heat exhaustion. So fans are, you know, a real commodity, and you don't have a fan unless somebody in your family can buy it for you. So there were lots of guys that didn't have fans, and so John left a fan. He left a radio. He left his dictionary. I've got. I spent 2 days planning for the funeral of a living, you know, helping a living, breathing man plan his own funeral and the distribution of what goods he had.
Anything else you want to say about the song before we hear it?
It was part of a process that I'm probably still going through of processing, having. It's not a political song. My other death penalty songs are. They deal with my opposition to the death penalty as an idea. This is simply me processing the fact that I witnessed a horrific act.
Okay, this is Steve Earle, his song, Over Yonder, Jonathan's Song.
had it coming. I can't ever pay enough, and all my ripping and running, I hurt everyone I loved. The world to turn around without me, the sun will come up in the east, shining down on all of them that hate me. I hope my going brings them peace. Well, I'm going over yonder where no ghosts will follow me. There's another place beyond here where I'll be free. Yeah, that's what I believe.
And that's Over Yonder, Jonathan Song, from Steve Earle's latest CD, Transcendental Blues. Well, you talked about how in writing the song you felt you were still processing, having witnessed the execution. When did you write your short story in your new book that's about witnessing an execution?
I went to Galway in Ireland right after John was executed on October 7th, not quite 3 years ago. And I left the country around the 15th or so, within a week after John was executed. And I went to Ireland for several months. And part of it was, to just sort of get away for a while, because I'd been working pretty hard, and then I witnessed an execution, and I needed the rest, and also to work on this book. By that time, I had a publisher and had an editor, and I was trying to write enough stories for a collection so I could publish this someday. And I wrote two stories. I wrote Over Yonder and finished a couple of stories I was working on, and I sort of laid out this story, The Witness, which is fiction. It's actually got a whole another sort of plot going on in it, but it definitely draws very heavily from what I saw that day.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Steve Earle. He has a new collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve Earle, and he's a singer, songwriter, and guitarist with many CDs. He also now has his first book of short stories. It's called Doghouse Roses. Before I ask you to read an excerpt of your short story, The Witness, about witnessing an execution, I want to ask you what you were most unprepared for when you witnessed the execution of Jonathan Wayne Nobles.
My own empathy for the people that had to participate in that execution. John was really incredibly well prepared, and it was hard to watch. He was genuinely remorseful, and he was just trying to die the best that he could. But the other people, I don't know where it came from. I didn't see anything from them that would normally evoke empathy, but it just dawned on me what I was looking at was people protecting a relatively low-paying job with halfway decent benefits. It's the only industry in Huntsville, Texas, and is the prison system. And this damages everybody that touches it. My objection to the death penalty is not about what it does to the guys on death row as much as it is what it does to all of us. I object to the damage it does to my spirit if I kill somebody, and if my government kills somebody, then I'm killing somebody.
Well, let me ask you to read an excerpt of The Witness, and this story is told from the point of view of a corporate attorney whose wife was murdered, and the man convicted of murdering his wife is about to be executed. The corporate attorney is there to witness the execution, and at this moment is in the story, the man being executed has just picked up his head and stared at the observers. You want to pick it up from there?
Yeah. He mercifully turned away Staring straight up at the ceiling, he took a long, ragged breath, closed his eyes, and began saying a Hail Mary in Spanish. Gordon noticed that Chaplain Meeks was resting his right hand on Camacho's leg just below the knee. For some reason that he couldn't explain, the contact offended him. Now more than ever, Gordon wanted the whole horrible business over with. Finish. What Gordon didn't know was that the Hail Mary was the signal that Camacho had agreed to so that Warden Larkin knew he was ready, and Gordon had missed the warden's subtle hand signal to the unseen executioner behind the one-way glass. Therefore, he had no way of knowing that the poison had already made its way down the plastic tubing and was racing through Andres Camacho's body. Ahora y en la hora de la muerte nuestra. Andy's prayer was interrupted by a sound from his own lips, a low-pitched bark, a startling incongruous sound like a small child with whooping cough, as the air was suddenly forced from his lungs and his head pitched forward until his chin lodged on his chest. It was as if an invisible anvil had been dropped on his chest from a great height. It was much more violent than Gordon had ever imagined it would be. He had somehow convinced himself that this would be different somehow. On paper, it was efficient and clinical. Instead, there was the unmistakable sense that he was witnessing a soul being brutally and unnaturally ripped from a human body.
Now, you know that kind of barking that you're describing, that the executed man goes through at the moment of death? Is that something that happened in the execution you witnessed?
Yeah, and it varies. I mean, some people, I know people that have witnessed executions. I was fortunate enough to have a lady named Karen Sebung, who had witnessed an execution before me, who I was friendly with in Houston. That prepared me to some extent for what I was going to see, and it's different. I mean, some people yawn, and some people, there's a gasp, but basically, it's a massive dose of pentobarbital, and which that, we're told that that's to put them to sleep before the second chemical collapses their lungs, and the truth of the matter is, a massive overdose of pentobarbital collapses your lungs. The second one makes sure that they don't inflate themselves, because people have different tolerances to drugs. What I saw and John's execution was, it was so, John was singing when he was executed. His signal was, he sang Silent Night. And when he got to the line, Mother and Child, the sound was so loud, it was like, huh! And then he didn't make another sound, and he didn't move. But as he expelled that air, his head pitched forward violently enough that his heavy plastic prison glasses fell off of his face, bounced off of his chest, and landed on the floor.
You didn't take notes at the execution, did you?
No, I couldn't have if I'd wanted to. I mean, the press can do that, but I couldn't have done that.
You mean you weren't allowed to?
No, I wasn't allowed. You're not. Texas is one of the most restrictive death row. You don't. There are no contact visits on death row. You can't take any writing instruments into death row, or into the walls, which is where the executions actually take place.
Why did you want to write a story about this?
Well, I wanted to do it because it's how I process things. I've been writing all my life, you know, I mean, I had John's permission explicitly, which I didn't ask for. I spent, the last time I saw John where I could talk to him was at 12:30, right before he was taken over to the walls, the day of his execution. Texas executes people at 6 in the evening. So one of the last things he said to me was, he says, "You have my permission to use anything that you saw here against the death penalty or, you know, for artistic reasons." And that wasn't something that I asked him for. And I probably, if he hadn't said that, I probably would have written it down, but I probably wouldn't have published anything.
One of the observations that you make in your short story about the execution is that, you know, a lot of convicts have been junkies, and for a former junkie who's getting executed, it's harder to find veins for the lethal injection IV. How'd you learn about that?
Well, I mean, it's not. I've been doing work against the death penalty for a long time. I've watched states changeover from, you know, we keep track of, you know, Florida had the electric, has had, you know, held out on the electric chair longer than anybody, but a lot of states have recently switched over to lethal injection. And in the early days of lethal injection, there have been botched executions by that method as well. And one of the problems that they run into is that there's 80% of the people we have behind bars in this country for any reason are there for drug-related charges. A lot of those people are IV drug addicts. That's the main reason the, you know, that AIDS is so prevalent in our prison system. I've been through having to have medical procedures myself and had them have trouble finding a vein. Sometimes I've been to the dentist a few times when I wanted to, you know, I had to have a lot of dental work done right after I got clean. And a couple of times I've wanted to just take needles away from people because I felt like I could do a better job than they could. But it's a common problem. And these are stories that unfortunately pass around among people that have witnessed executions and just people around the movement in general.
Steve Earle will be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer-songwriter, guitarist, and record producer Steve Earle. He's just published his first book, a collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses. In 1994, Earle was arrested for possession of narcotics. He spent several months in prison and then went into rehab. He launched a successful comeback in 1995, which has included 5 albums, 3 Grammy nominations, and founding his own record label, E Squared. The last time we spoke, it was pretty shortly in your comeback after you gave up dope. How easy or hard has it been to stay clean? I mean, your career has really been doing well. Your records, as far as I can tell, have been doing well. And
Right. You've
been producing records by other people. I mean, it seems like your comeback has been pretty successful. But how hard has it been to keep healthy?
It hasn't been easy, but it's been simple. I know what to do. I tried everything else, and I still do exactly the same things that I was doing when we last spoke. I'm maybe even more dedicated to that way of life now. It is my way of life. It's my spiritual system. And I really didn't have one before. So I've watched people with more time than I have relapse, and that's happened a couple of times recently. I've got not quite 7 years. I'll have 7 years in September if I keep doing the right stuff. And I've seen a few people with 12 and 14 years clean relapse recently, and that's terrifying. But it doesn't have to happen. I know that too. I've seen other people, relapse is not necessarily a part of recovery. And if I keep doing the right things, I really do believe that it'll continue to work for me.
Now that you've been writing a lot, how has writing affected what you're reading? Are you reading more than ever?
Well, I read a lot. I've got an 8th grade education, so I've sort of had to educate myself. I've always read a lot. I read a lot more nonfiction than I do fiction. I read a lot of nonfiction, and I read a lot of poetry, and I read some fiction. I read all the time, but I go through periods of, you know, I'll discover a writer, and I have a tendency to discover a writer and then read absolutely everything they've written in a relatively short period of time. I was that way. I discovered Graham Greene in my late 20s and read absolutely everything. I read and reread Mark Twain to this day. God knows how many times I've read Huckleberry Finn, and I completely and totally agree with Ernest Hemingway when he said that don't bother to go write the great American novel because it's already been written and it's called Huckleberry Finn. Lately I've been reading Michael Ondaatje. Probably wrote my favorite book. It's called Coming Through Slaughter. And it's I guess it's his first novel, but it's I guess it was published in 79, somewhere in there. He's a great poet, and of course he's known more for novels that he's written since then. But Coming Through Slaughter is like a form of literature that, as far as I know, didn't exist before then. It is poetry, and it is prose, and it is history. It deals with a person who really lived, Buddy Bolden, who was a cornet player in New Orleans at the turn of the century, who somewhat of an enigma just because no one knows what he sounded like because he never made records. His career existed before electronic recording, but everyone that came out of New Orleans heard him play. Louis Armstrong knew what Buddy Bolden sounded like. So in a way, we've all heard Buddy Bolden, his influence.
Steve Earle is my guest, and he's a singer, songwriter, guitarist with several CDs, and now he has a new book of short stories, which is called Doghouse Roses. You've been producing records by other people, including Lucinda Williams and Ron Sexsmith. Why have you gotten so involved in producing other people's music?
I think it's about teaching. I also teach a course at the Old Town School of Folk Music, and I do that for the same reason that I produce records. Teaching is really important. If you teach and you do it right, then you learn so much. And I steal shamelessly from younger bands that I produce, and sometimes it's contemporaries. I mean, we're working with Lucinda. That's someone I've known since I was 17 years old, and we sort of came up together in the same circles in Texas. But my favorite thing is producing baby bands that have never made a record before. Ron is a great writer. Ron's like, I've known him for a long time. And he was kind of a protege at one point years ago, but he's grown up into this. You know, he's as good as most people are lyrically, and he has no peer in pop music melodically nowadays. I don't think anyone else writes melodies like that. But the thing that's really fun is producing records on bands like Six String Drag and finding bands like Marat and, young bands that have never made a record before. That's fun. That's when, and if you're doing it right, you learn a huge amount. And hopefully you can make it easier for people to concentrate on what's important, when they're in the studio, when they're in an uncomfortable environment, and help them learn their way around that environment and how to make records for the rest of their lives.
Influences that you've recently gotten deeper into include bluegrass and the Beatles. And there's a lot of harmony in both of those, although the harmonies are different.
Yeah.
Have you gotten more involved in singing harmony?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've gotten, I write, the main thing that's changed in my writing is I write more chick songs.
More chick songs? What does that mean?
it means I write a lot more pretty songs, which serves several purposes. I've become more interested in melody. It also prevents my audience from getting exponentially hairier and uglier as time goes on, because I have to look at them, too.
So let's get back to harmony.
Harmony's like something that's been a weak suit for me. And I was always a really bad harmony singer. But from singing with people that were good harmony singers over the last few years, I've gotten better at it. And so I don't automatically break out when someone, people will very casually ask you to come sing harmony on their record and as a guest. And that used to cause me a lot of consternation. And I feel a lot more confident when I'm asked to do that, because I think I understand how harmony works a little bit better.
The title story in your new book, Doghouse Roses, is about somebody who's kind of leaving town. It starts off with somebody who's leaving town after a relationship has fallen apart. And, we've been talking a little bit about how you've been writing about similar subjects in your songs and in your stories. The idea of being on the road or hitting the road is... Well, it's one of the oldest subjects in certainly in country music and in rock music and the blues. And even on your new CD, on your most recent CD, Transcendental Blues, there's two songs about the road. And one of them is about the person threatening to hit the road and burn the house down.
Right.
And in the other, the person has been on the road and they're thinking giving up the road and hanging up their highway shoes.
Right.
And they're really good songs that are opposite sides of the same coin. I'm wondering if that's been a theme in your life, the desire to hit the road and the desire to get off the road.
Sure it has, but, and I'm dealing with it right now. I'm getting towards the end of the tour. I'm in the best relationship I've ever been in my life. I like to be home a lot better, a lot more than I used to. And Sarah is sort of like, like almost everybody else I've ever been with, it's like, well, I knew you toured, but I didn't know you toured. And this tour's gone on longer than I intended to. And so I'm ready for it to be over with. At the same time, I am, I have to admit that I do, when I'm home for any, you know, for an extended period of time, I start wondering what it would be like to get back on a bus. And I like to roll after the show and spend the night on the bus and wake up in another town. And I've been doing it for most of my life. But things are slowing down a little bit. And actually, Another Town was written, the one about burning the house down, was written, I was using tools that I'd been using in writing songs about leaving towns all my life and trying to lend somebody else a voice, because that song was written for Sarah to sort of lend her a voice. And when we first met and she was in a situation where I think she needed to make a move, and I was just sort of being a cheerleader there, whereas Steve's Last Ramble is a little bit more just me.
Well, I thought maybe we'd play the beginning of those back-to-back.
Okay.
And compare these two instincts. Steve Earle, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your music and your stories.
Thank you.
Two songs from Steve Earle's latest CD, Transcendental Blues. His new collection of short stories is called Doghouse Roses. This is Fresh Air.